I had a couple of responses during that break, and one, my daughter shared with me that Zechariah chapter 5 and verse 1 has particular meaning to any middle school teacher who is doing lunchroom duty. The last phrase. Yes, behold the flying roll. So she said she had used that on a number of detention slips. And then someone else was mentioning to me about the crowns and combining the crowns, and it certainly had been done historically, of combining two crowns into one, and that it was a possible thing to do, which seems to me eminently explainable there. I think, again, the important principle is that we're placing a crown upon Joshua, the priest. And so that's the key point that is there. So don't miss that in the rest of it. That combination of a crown, which should go upon the king, is being placed on the high priest. And so that's that combination of offices that are going here, and that foretelling the Lord Jesus Christ in the combining of those two offices. Well, we come now to the second major division of the book, which deals with chapters 7 and 8. So we have the introduction and the visions, the eight visions, and the crowning of Joshua, again, as a subset of all of that. So you really have the eight visions with the introduction ahead of that, and then the crowning of Joshua as, in a sense, a culmination for it, a point that pulls all of that together in foreshadowing the coming Messiah, the branch. And then we come to chapters 7 and 8. This is, again, a kind of a little segment that is inserted here and sets forth those who are coming and asking about fasting and whether they should continue to fast. So let's read chapter 7, and we'll look at which divides really into a negative response in chapter 7 and a positive response in chapter 8. And it came to pass in the fourth year of King Darius that the word of the Lord came to Zechariah on the fourth day of the ninth month, even in Chislu. But they had sent unto the house of God Sherezer and Regimelech and their men to pray before the Lord, and to speak unto the priests which were in the house of the Lord of hosts, and to the prophet, saying, Should I weep in the fifth month, separating myself as I have done these so many years? Then came the word of the Lord of hosts unto me, saying, Speak unto all the people of the land, and to the priests, saying, When ye fasted and mourned in the fifth and seventh month, even those 70 years, did ye at all fast unto me, even to me? And when ye did eat, and when ye did drink, did not ye eat for yourselves and drink for yourselves? Should ye not hear the words which the Lord hath cried by the former prophets, when Jerusalem was inhabited and in prosperity, and the cities thereof round about her, when men inhabited the south and the plain? And the word of the Lord came unto Zechariah, saying, Thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, saying, Execute true judgment, and show mercy and compassions every man to his brother, and oppress not the widow, nor the fatherless, the stranger, nor the poor, and let none of you imagine evil against his brother in your heart. But they refused to hearken, and pulled away the shoulder, and stopped their ears, that they should not hear. Yea, they made their hearts as an adamant stone, lest they should hear the law, and the words which the Lord of hosts hath sent in his spirit by the former prophets. Therefore came a great wrath from the Lord of hosts. Therefore it is come to pass that as he cried, and they would not hear, so they cried, and I would not hear, said the Lord of hosts. But I scattered them with a whirlwind among all the nations whom they knew not. Thus the land was desolate after them, that no man passed through nor returned, for they laid the pleasant land desolate. We have in these events group of people who come from Bethel to inquire of Zechariah whether or not they were to continue to keep the fasting that they had been doing. There were two particular fasts that they identify here, a fast during the fifth month and a fast during the seventh month. The fifth month commemorated the destruction of the temple by Nebuchadnezzar, which had occurred almost exactly 70 years earlier of their coming to ask whether to keep going with the fast. The seventh month marked the murder of Gedaliah, who was the first Jewish governor appointed under Nebuchadnezzar after the fall of Jerusalem. And then he was murdered, and after that there was a fast kept in mourning of this ungodly murder of Gedaliah. Now, it's important to note that God never commanded the keeping of these particular fasts. This was something they decided to do. Now, we do have instructions in the Old Testament, certainly, about the various festivals, feasts, fasts, all of this of what they were to do, but these are not included in any instruction from God. So now the issue has arisen. This was there because of what had happened, and so for 70 years, we're told that they've been keeping this fast over this mourning of what had happened and how tragic it was. Now the temple rebuilding is underway. The Jews are back in the land. So then, they come to the priest to find out, should we continue to fast and mourn now that the temple is underway again? So this is the issue, this is the question that they are bringing. What we find out in chapter 7, as we read this, when you read the first part of it, it sounds, yeah, you know, that certainly seems reasonable. And here they were doing this, a good group of people, really heartbroken over what had happened. And here they were, fasting all of this time, doing this as unto the Lord, a heart for God, real genuineness there, and now they come to the right source to find out from the priest, is this something that we need to continue to do? Sure looks good. But, you know, when you read the rest of it, God throws a lot of commentary on the purposes of the heart, doesn't he? There are lots of things that look good to us, but God looks on the heart. And that's what we have in chapter 7. God goes beyond the facade, and he looks at their motive. That's where things get a little scary, isn't it? He doesn't just look at the action, he looks at why we are carrying out the action. Why are we doing what we are doing? And basically, he looks at this and says, this is basically a sham. This is outward show. There was no heart in it. There was no genuine sorrow in it. There was simply a ritual that was devoid of content and substance. They were going through motions, and that was all. You know, that's what, as they say, kind of scary for us. Because God really knows what is in our heart. He looks at our motives. And you look at, you know, the exterior and the interior. And man, in so many ways, and some of the psychological theories, et cetera, wants to really look at the exterior. And some have discounted anything that's going on inside. And the response, had a professor like that at LSU at one time, and said, it doesn't really make any difference. There's nothing really inside anyway. The only thing that's important is what you do and to modify behavior, and you've heard of behavior modification. And it's all a behavioral psychology point of view that we manipulate behavior, we modify behavior, and we can do this. And we do it sometimes through a process of rewards or punishments. And it can work to a limited degree at times. I remember years ago when our children were small, we decided to try that with one of our children. I will not. Kathy shall remain nameless. And, okay. This child had a tendency to want to be at the table and to put fingers in the plate. and proceed with, instead of using the utensils, to use the most economical means of transferring food to one's mouth. And we tended to discourage that. So then, consequently, every meal became a don't do this, flap, flap, don't do this. So finally, we decided to use a little behavioral modification, reinforcement techniques, etc., deal with behavior, stop talking about it being wrong, good, bad, etc. We just said, okay, and this was the days before inflation and all of this. We said, every meal that we go through, we don't have to say anything to you about putting your fingers in your plate. It's worth, I think it was a penny. Yeah? Big deal. We forgot about it. I think the next day, dinner time, and meal and food, we hadn't even really noticed. It had been a very peaceful meal. And at the end of the meal, she looks over, bright-eyed, and says, okay, pay up. You know? And this went on for a while. It worked. I mean, it just transformed our meals for a while. Then the price went up, and we cut it out. So it's and that's the problem with reinforcement of that kind. The price increases, you know, as you go along. But the whole emphasis there, and many have that kind of view, that we modify behavior, and it doesn't really matter what's inside as long as you get the behavior you want. But God doesn't look at it that way. And if you look at Corinthians, 1 Corinthians chapter 13, and you have a classic example there of interior versus exterior. Mm-hmm. What's going on inside and what's going on outside and what God looks at. And he says, you know, if I take all my goods, I take everything I have, I sell my house, our house, I sell... Quick collection, you'll notice, don't you? I sell our house, I sell clothes, sell the car, sell the whole shebang, everything. Keep one suit of clothes, that's it. Give it all away, take it down, Greenville Rescue Mission, say, here, you got the whole schmeal. And I give them all $500, you know. So, the whole thing. It's gone. And the headline in paper, local man, the great philanthropist, gives all to the poor. You know, I don't have a thing. Got one suit of clothes left. That's it. Living in a box down under the trestle, you know. And God says, okay, why'd you do it? I said, wait. I don't have anything. It's all gone. Why'd you do it? Well, it's you know, I gave it to the poor. Let's look inside. Did you do that because you wanted your name in the paper to say, philanthropist, give away all, or was it a real motive? He says, I give my body to be burned. You know, this is me. This is one time around. And my body, I give it. And God says, okay, why? What was the purpose behind that? And he goes internally and looks inside and says, what was your motive for doing that? And notice, if I had the wrong motive, all of that doesn't count for anything. Big zero. Wow. You know, I think there are going to be a lot of interesting surprises when we get to heaven. When the Lord passes out rewards. There are going to be a lot of people that we see what they're doing here and we think, wow. And God looks at why they are doing it, and He doesn't say, wow. And there are going to be a lot of others that we haven't seen a lot going on. We don't see what is being done. It's being done in the back corner somewhere. It's being done out of the limelight. And there are going to be some rewards given to people that we never would have expected. And there are going to be a lot of others that aren't going to be as bright as what we might have thought. So God is looking at the motivation. And that's the lesson I think that we have here for a practical lesson for us. And I hope as we're going through, you're seeing some places where the intent of this, the interpretation is not for us in the church age right now. There can be applications from Zechariah. And I think this is an application that's here. And someone was mentioning a minute ago with the cleansing and clothing of Joshua, an application that is there that is applicable to us in the church age and applicable to what God does in the cleansing work through the blood of Jesus Christ. So all of these things are applications that we can see in this book, but which are not necessarily interpretations. It's not what was designed in terms of the specific goal of the message being given. Okay? But I think it's a legitimate application for us, a principle that we can take out of it for use today. And I hope you're seeing some of these echo through here and some passages you think, oh, I want to go back to that and I'd like to look at that some more because there's a lot here. So that's really what I'm hoping for as a result of this. So God says, it was a hypocritical question designed to impress the hearers, not a matter of piety, but of posturing. Wow. When they came and asked, it's not a matter of genuine godliness that they really wanted to know. It was a matter of posturing before. You know what we've been doing? We have been fasting all of this time for God. Now, dear priests, should we continue to carry out this duty to God that we have been so faithful in doing? And God says, that's phony. Phony, phony, phony. It was simply a posturing to impress those who were there. Merrill's comment, their religion had become one of outward show with no inner content. Like their fathers, they were ignoring God's warnings through the prophets. And he repudiates the acts of religious observance and particularly fasting while not ignoring the substance. And notice what he emphasizes in here, what he encourages them, go back, show mercy, compassion, don't oppress the widow or the fatherless. In other words, these were things that were going on, the things that prophets had warned against earlier. And he does make reference to that the earlier prophets had warned their fathers about. And by implication, this was still continuing. So on the one side, here we are doing all of these things to their fellow man, while over here in a very pious state, they are fasting unto the Lord because of the destruction of the temple. And they missed the whole point of the destruction of the temple, which was because of their ungodly actions. And so they're putting on a facade, they're going through some motions, but they still haven't learned the lesson. They have missed the whole central point. So here are moral and spiritual guidelines that are given here. It's not in the ritual, it is in the reality that God is concerned. You know, and I think that even when we come to the Lord's Supper, you know, we have to examine our hearts, and we're told to do that, to examine ourselves. And I think we have to make sure that our hearts are right before the Lord. Otherwise, we may come and it just becomes a ritual, an empty process that we go through, and it should not be that. It needs to be something that is fresh. It needs to be a genuine time of worship, a genuine time of heart searching before we come before the Lord. Let me just read this last statement here. Unless members of Zechariah's audience, in this case the Bethel delegation, but by extension all persons of the post-exilic community, understand the abhorrence with which Jehovah views religious observance that is only superficial and self-serving, they can expect the same calamitous results as those experienced by their forefathers. And I think, again, he talks about the scattering that's going to occur, verses 13 and 14. I think we have, in a sense, multiple references here that certainly a near reference to this can be what occurred with their forefathers and being carried off into Babylon. Another reference that we find the scattering that takes place and the desolation that occurs during the time when Rome goes in and right after the time of Christ, the destruction of Jerusalem and all of this, and the scattering of the Jews in the modern age. Okay? And then ultimately, it's going to be even a greater scattering that is going to occur and taking place during this tribulation time of, again, great judgment from God. So I think there are at least three different areas that we can look at for the fulfillment of this, because its ultimate fulfillment has not taken place yet. But certainly, under Nebuchadnezzar, and there under what happened with the Roman judgment that came upon Jerusalem, represent this, and I think finally another judgment that is coming from God that will scatter. Now we come to chapter 8. Come to chapter 8. And here we have a positive response. So the negative in chapter 7, the positive occurs in chapter 8. Again, the word of the Lord of hosts came unto me, saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts, I was jealous for Zion with great jealousy, and I was jealous for her with great fury. Thus saith the Lord, I am returned unto Zion, and will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. And Jerusalem shall be called a city of truth, and the mountain of the Lord of hosts, the holy mountain. Wow. Isn't that great? You know, there's what God is going to do. He's going to dwell in Jerusalem. Thus saith the Lord of hosts. There shall yet old men and old women dwell in the streets of Jerusalem, and every man with his staff in his hand for very age. And the streets of the city shall be full of boys and girls, playing in the streets thereof. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, if it be marvelous in the eyes of the remnant of this people in these days, should it also be marvelous in mine eyes, saith the Lord of hosts. And that word marvelous, there are better translations. Some of you probably have a different translation of that, hard or difficult. In other words, if it's difficult for you when I say that, is it difficult for me? Thus saith the Lord of hosts, behold, I will save my people from the east country and from the west country. And I will bring them, and they shall dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. And they shall be my people, and I will be their God in truth and in righteousness. Wow, there is a verse again. Pull out, circle, bracket, underline. Here, great promise of God of encouragement to them of what He is going to do. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, let your hands be strong, ye that hear in these days these words by the mouth of the prophets, which were in the day that the foundation of the house of the Lord of hosts was laid, that the temple might be built. For before these days there was no hire for man, nor any hire for beast, neither was there any peace to him that went out or came in because of the affliction. For I set all man, every one, against his neighbor. But now I will not be under the residue of this people as in the former days, saith the Lord of hosts. For the seed shall be prosperous, the vine shall give her fruit, and the ground shall give her increase, and the heavens shall give their dew, and I will cause the remnant of this people to possess all these things. And let me just stop here for a moment again. Very specific reference to the times, because the same promise that God gives to Haggai, He says to Haggai and to the people, look back before you started, when you were about your own things, before you started back into work rebuilding the temple. What happened? Well, your money was, if you had holes in your pockets, it was all going out. Your crops didn't grow. There was a drought. There was no rain. All of the problems. But God says, okay, now that we're back rebuilding, the blessing will come. The rain will fall. In other words, times are going to be better. And this is what He's making reference to here of what had happened earlier. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, as I thought to punish you when your fathers provoked me to wrath, saith the Lord of hosts, and I repented not, so again have I thought in these days to do well unto Jerusalem and to the house of Judah, fear ye not. These are the things that ye shall do. Speak ye every man the truth to his neighbor. Execute the judgment of truth and peace in your gates. And let none of you imagine evil in your hearts against his neighbor. And love no false oath. For all these are the things that I hate, saith the Lord. And the word of the Lord of hosts came unto me, saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the fast of the fourth month, and the fast of the fifth, and the fast of the seventh, and the fast of the tenth, shall be to the house of Judah joy and gladness and cheerful feast, therefore love, truth, and peace. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, it shall yet come to pass, and there shall come people, and the inhabitants of many cities. And the inhabitants of one city shall go to another, saying, let us go speedily to pray before the Lord, and to seek the Lord of hosts. I will go also. Yea, many people and strong nations shall come to seek the Lord of hosts in Jerusalem, and to pray before the Lord. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, in those days it shall come to pass that 10 men shall take hold out of all languages the nations, even shall take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew, saying, we will go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. Wow. That's almost gets you on shopping ground, doesn't it? I mean, this is of what God is going to do. Again, He's not talking about the church here, but He's talking about His ultimate plan and what God is going to fulfill with the Jews. The Jews, which are held in so much contempt around the globe have had such enormous persecution, and we see some of that even being resurrected today, some of the anti-Semitism that existed in earlier periods, some of it even in the United States. Certainly in Europe, there's been a resurgence of a modern neo-Nazism that has taken place there, and all of this. But what we're going to find here, what are they going to do? They're going to take hold and say, let us go with you. A ratio of 10 to 1. Not 10 to 1 to beat him up, but 10 to 1 to take hold and say, God is with you. Let us go with you to worship your God, because we see the evidence of your God in your midst, and He is the true God. My, what a turnaround. What a change. Only to be brought about by the power and the might of God. Now notice, he does connect this, the connection that we have to chapter 7, because he doesn't mention the delegation at all. He doesn't say anything back directly to them, but really in verse 19 ties it into a connection here, because there he talks about the fast, and the fast of the fifth month, and the seventh month, and the tenth month, and so on. And he says, all of that fasting, oh, that's going to be different. It's going to be feasting. It's going to be joy. It's not going to be a time of mourning. Now, there is a time of mourning that is yet to come. That is going to be there. But ultimately, it is going to be glorious. It is going to be joy unto the Lord. The point he makes here, as I said, about the marvelous over and what is going to take place. We come back to the earlier part of chapter 8. And he describes what is going to happen in Jerusalem, and it's going to be a city where full of old and young. And then we had earlier the city that will not be able to contain all of the people, and God being the defense. So here is this enormous amount of people there, old people, young people, all are there. It's just a picture of what God is going to do. For we didn't see many there at that time. It's a remnant that has returned. And it's an important point that he makes. What is difficult for us is not difficult for God. He says, is this hard or difficult, marvelous in your eyes? Well, it is not hard or difficult in my eyes. Verse 6, if it be marvelous or difficult in the eyes of the remnant of this people, should it also be difficult in mine eyes? Is anything too hard for me? You know, God specializes in the hard task. And when those are there, that's when we see the glory of God, when it brings about, when He does those things, again, not by power, not by might, but by my Spirit. It's God's working and achieving, and nothing is too difficult for Him. Which doesn't mean we ought to go out and do something stupid. Okay? You know, I hear people, you know, all the time, and they want to start a building program. So they say, okay, we're going to start a $20 million building program because nothing is too difficult for God. And He can. That's presumption. Okay? And that's not what he is talking about here. He's talking about God's plan to bring about his purposes. So be sure that the plans we have are in line with what's in the book, because these are the plans of God. And it's not a matter of getting God to line up with us. It's much more a matter of our lining up with God and making sure that our plans are on his track and going in his direction. Israel is going to be regathered from all over the earth. They are going to become a blessing to all people as they point the way to the true God. Now, I think Barron makes the point of this already being realized in the person of Jesus Christ. So Israel is already being a blessing because Jesus Christ of the nation of Israel. And through Him, all the nations are blessed today in Christ. So, but ultimately, the realization of that and the blessing of the nations will take place in the millennium. And it concludes, the whole section concludes, with a fasting that is turned to feasting. Joyous feasting for the people of God in right relationship with Him. And all of these nations, and we'll find this in chapter 14, are coming to Jerusalem to worship the true God. And of course, the Lord of hosts is emphasized throughout the chapter, and all of this is only going to be accomplished by the Lord of hosts, the one of power and of might. How are we doing on time? Okay, good for a while. All right, great. So we'll get into the introduction, at least, into this next section, which is the section of prophecies. And so a couple of we'll deal with probably with some of the issues that are there as we come to 9 through 14, and then probably get actually into it. What do we got? One more session? Okay. Maybe we'll get to probably get further than that this time. All right. In the prophecies 9 through 14, and a major overview here, Barron's quotation, the overthrow of world power, the establishment of Messiah's kingdom, may be given an epitome of the last chapters of Zechariah. We've had that suggested to us, indicated to us in the earlier portions, but now this becomes the dominant theme here. It contains prophecies that were fulfilled before the coming of Christ, some during his earthly ministry, and some that will be fulfilled during the tribulation and kingdom age. The two sections, chapters 9 through 11, deal with the nations and their overthrow, and in 12 through 14 is God's refining of Israel and setting up the ultimate kingdom, his kingdom during that time. Now, one of the areas of controversy that has occurred is with chapters 9 through 14, and it's over the authorship. And the discussion here is whether or not Zechariah wrote chapters 9 through 14. Almost all will agree that chapters 1 through 8 are by Zechariah. But when you come to chapter 9, you find a vast, vast difference, both in subject matter and in style. It's almost as if you start a different book in some ways. So both conservative scholars, liberal scholars, all serious students of the book of Zechariah will grant that you have a major stylistic, substantive difference when you come to the beginning of chapter 9. The question is, how do we explain that difference? The more liberal scholars want to explain it by saying Zechariah didn't write it, because there are just too many differences in style. And so it's written by probably a group that they would see of post-exile and others that came together at a later date. And they want to argue importantly for a later date. That's an important aspect of this to them, because in here he makes a specific reference to Greece. Greece at this time, the empire, Alexander the Great, was not a dominant empire. It was not on the horizon at this point. So that troubles them that there is a specific reference to Greece in here at its point. And so their argument is, one, style and substance, because the reference to Greece, it must be by later writers once Greece was on the horizon and coming up. So what really troubles them is what the book is, prophecy. And so prophecy bothers them, you know, if it's real prophecy. And we don't have any problem explaining it. We just say, that's prophecy. It's the inspired word of God. So God was telling you what was going to happen before it happened. So conservatives don't have a problem with that part of it. But the real issue, though, is what do we do with style? Most will explain it by saying the subject matter shifts. And in the approach of the subject matter, if you look at even contemporary writers, you will find different approaches to style as you write on different subjects. Okay? So it's perfectly explainable because of the nature of the material. And most of us don't have a major problem. In fact, one writer comments and says, the people that are criticizing it themselves, when they're writing on one thing and writing on something else, write with different styles. And they just won't admit it in terms of Zechariah. So I don't think the problem, and neither do others, is nearly as big as others want to make it. Now, a second issue revolves around a passage we're going to encounter here. And let's go over to Matthew. Matthew 27. And this also deals with authorship. Matthew 27. And this is the episode of Judas here. And let's begin with verse 3. Then Judas, which had betrayed him, when he saw that he was condemned, repented himself and brought again the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, I have sinned in that I have betrayed the innocent blood. And they said, what is that to us? See thou to it. And he cast down the pieces of silver in the temple and departed and went and hanged himself. And the chief priests took the silver pieces and said, it is not lawful for to put them into the treasury, because it is the price of blood. And they took counsel and bought for them the potter's field to bury the strangers in. When therefore that field was called the field of blood unto this day. Then was fulfilled that which was spoken by Jeremy the prophet, saying, and they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of him that was valued, whom they of the children of Israel did value, and gave them for the potter's field, as the Lord appointed. Note the reference for that. He is citing Jeremiah. Go through the book of Jeremiah, and you won't find a reference to the 30 pieces of silver. Okay? Come to Zechariah chapter 11. And here, the whole scheme, we'll look at it in detail later on, of what was being taking place here. But here's the 30 pieces of silver in Zechariah 11. And I said to them, if ye think good, this is verse 12 of chapter 11, give me my price, and if not, forbear. So they weighed for my price 30 pieces of silver. The Lord said unto me, cast it unto the potter, a goodly price that I was prized out of them. And I took the 30 pieces of silver and cast them to the potter in the house of the Lord. Okay. Now, Matthew is obviously speaking and talking about this particular event that Judas did, and he is quoting this with the 30 pieces of silver in the potter's house that we have referenced in Zechariah. And Matthew says, Jeremiah. And that presents a problem for us, doesn't it? Okay, so we've got to deal with that particular issue. Very conservative scholars early on, so we talked about the liberals, who because of style and because of the reference of Greece, wanted to say that the last chapters of Zechariah were written by someone else other than Zechariah. So the liberals, we can discount that. But earlier, very conservative scholars also had problems with Zechariah's authorship of the last part of the book, because they said, we have no inspired text that tells us Zechariah wrote those last chapters, but here we have inspired text from Matthew telling us it was written by Jeremiah. So these were godly men, conservative men, who were saying the best authority that we have tells us this is from Jeremiah. So, several possibilities here. Okay. None of which, and anyone today, conservative scholars, no one today believes that this is written by Jeremiah. Okay. No one thinks it's written by someone else. Every conservative scholar today believes that this is indeed part of the writing of Zechariah, okay, and belongs there. So how is it that Matthew refers to Jeremiah? Okay. Two or three different possibilities that are here. Excuse me. One, it may be a copyist error. Now, don't throw rocks at me yet here, okay? What is the inspired text? The originals. Okay? The inspired text is the original manuscripts. What we have is a translation from those, from copies of copies of copies of copies. Is this a very accurate translation of copies of copies of copies? Absolutely. And if you take all of the contested passages, questions of possible copyist error from different manuscripts and put them all together, it would occupy perhaps one page of our entire scriptures. That's where people make a big ballyhoo at times of the accuracy. In fact, less than one page over all the passages about which any question is raised as to its authenticity of going back to original manuscripts. Are there probably some copyist errors in here somewhere from different manuscripts? Yes, there probably are. Okay. Many? No. Very, very few. Can I trust this Bible? Yes, absolutely. As the Word of God. Okay. But is it possible that there is a copyist who got a one letter changed for another letter? And it's very close in the Hebrew, the Zechariah, particularly in some of the abbreviations over there, Zechariah and Jeremiah, that could have been misread. Possible. That's a possible. I'm not even putting it as a choice. It's a possibility. Put it out for your thought. Another one, deal with a copyist error, would be that, as sometimes they were prone to do, which is to explain or fill in when they thought they knew something. For example, Matthew says many times, as recorded in the prophets, or as spoken by the prophets. And he doesn't give you the specific prophet. He just says, as spoken by the prophet. And so a copyist, wanting to help it out a little bit, familiar with similar passages in Jeremiah, writes in Jeremiah. Another possible explanation. Third explanation here. And for most of us, the most comforting are probably the best, though a bit involved. Go to Jeremiah chapter 19. Okay, we look at Jeremiah chapter 19, verse 1. Thus saith the Lord, go and get a potter's earthen bottle, and take of the ancients of the people, and of the ancients of the priests, and go forth into the valley of the son of Hinnom, which is by the entry of the east gate, and proclaim there the words that I shall tell thee. And hear and say, hear ye the word of the Lord, O kings of Judah, inhabitants of Jerusalem. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I will bring evil upon this place, the which whosoever heareth, his ears shall tingle. And he goes on and describes this, and let's come on down to verse 11. And shall say unto them, thus saith the Lord of hosts, even so will I break this people and this city as one breaketh a potter's vessel that cannot be made whole again, and they shall bury them in Tophet till there be no place to bury. So, you have in Jeremiah, you have a potter, you have the east gate, which is going out to the potter's field, the burial ground, the cemetery, and you have the pottery here. So you have the pottery, you have the burial ground, you have the potter's field. All of those are included here in Jeremiah. When you go to Zechariah, you don't have all of those elements in Zechariah. So let's go back over to Zechariah and look at the elements that are there. In Zechariah, we have 30 pieces of silver that's given unto the potter, and it goes to the potter in the house of the Lord. It is cast to the potter. Apparently, the best, again, interpretation here is that he would have gone to the temple, and then in the temple, there would have been a potter working in the temple who was making pottery for the use of the priest because of all the different vessels that were used in the service of the Lord. So not unreasonable to assume. And again, within the large courtyard that is there, there were these types of things. So he goes to the temple, and he takes this money, and he casts it to the potter that's there. When we look at it in Matthew, we have him giving it back to the priest. The priest then goes out and buys potter's field for that. So in Zechariah, the action does not specifically, directly, completely correspond to everything that happens in what Judas does. So when you put together Jeremiah and Zechariah, you begin to get a more complete picture of what happens. You have the coins and the temple here in Zechariah. You have the potter's field and the cemetery there in Jeremiah. So, what some will argue, and I think this is Barron and some of the others will argue, that the connection is that what the Holy Spirit is wanting to do is to bring both of those passages together in the fulfillment that is found in Judas's action. That no one of those completely fulfills the action, but taken together, they represent a fuller picture of what happens. So then, why does he call it Jeremiah rather than Zechariah? Because Jeremiah was a major prophet and Zechariah was a minor prophet. And Jeremiah was more well known. He is the prominent one, and whenever there is a difference, matters that go between the two, the major prophet is the one who is referenced rather than the minor prophet. So the reference to Jeremiah simply stands for the combination of those two. So those are the choices. Now, maybe somebody else, I don't know, anybody else has another choice. Those are the ones that I have run across, would be the actual linking of those. There is one other possibility, and that is just that it's referring to the prophets, Jeremiah representing the prophets, because in the Hebrew Bible, the first of the prophets is Jeremiah rather than the way it is in our English Bibles. So there is another theory that he just references Jeremiah in a general sense as representative of the prophets. And so instead of just saying as it is in the prophets, as it was in Jeremiah, representing all. Personally, I'm inclined toward the view that the Holy Spirit is directing Matthew to pull together both Jeremiah and Zechariah into one reference fulfilled in the actions of Judas. So, but again, there is no one, at least that I know of, clear, absolute answer that even the conservative scholars would all agree on that point. There are certainly different points of view, good arguments that are made by each one of them. So my reference and meant to you is simply search it out, look at it, explore it, read on it, and so on. Okay, I think we'll go ahead and stop here before we're going into the actual prophecies with chapter 9. That gives us 1 hour to get through 9 through 14. We're going to go fast. Okay. We can do it. That'll help keep you awake. I know how you guys really been good this morning. So, and I said, oh no, this is some heavy plowing in all of here. And I must confess there were a few times that I was studying it when I kind of, And so you're staying awake this morning, staying with me. This, I commend all of you for the alertness. And even though I saw Ken dozing off a few times over there, it wasn't any big deal. And it's okay, Ken. It's all right. We'll have you stand up next time. No, I didn't mean it. No. Don't want to identify. Okay. All right. Do we need to, are we ready to break for lunch? Do we need to give? Be glad to.